This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by listeners like you. Thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/thetomeshow. Welcome to The Tome, a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner, flying solo tonight. Well, flying without a co-host tonight. I am certainly not solo. We've got a wonderful panel of folks to join us as we draw a card to figure out all sorts of things other than powerful magical effects as we discuss the Book of Many Things, Part 2. Like I mentioned, we are without Tracy because she drew the dungeon and got trapped in a far-off prison realm. So, for the first person joining in this episode, I drew the Void. And now he's going to suck out our souls and protect them himself because he's the most powerful being around. He comes to us from the distant shores of Thaco with advantage and is the stealer of souls himself, Jared Rasher.
I was wondering which one I was going to be there, so this week I get to suck people's souls out. It's cool.
That's right. That's right. I have also drawn the Talons card, which means he's destroyed all of our magic items with his keen insight. Coming to us from Tribality and Edition Wars, it's the Tome Show's most taloned contributor, Brandon Stoddard.
God's sake. I would best not be identified with Mordenkainen's disjunction, but all right, if I gotta, I'll just take all the party's treasure. Bye.
There you go. And lastly, we drew the Throne for the most persuasive Lord of the Keep. He's been in the gaming world for a long time and, in fact, was the editor for this book, or one of the editors for this book.
An editor.
and is most well known for being my Gen Con roommate that one time. Welcome, yes. Eitan Bernstein.
Thank you.
It is nice to have all of you here, and I look forward to the conversation. For those who missed the last episode, we are talking about the Book of Many Things. It is a bit of a collection of a bunch of different things, almost like a deck of many things themed magazine articles. There's such a broad range of things that we decided this would be a good opportunity to try out a new format for the show. So rather than doing one episode talking about such a wide variety of things, we're going to break it down into a deep, deep dive and do it chapter by chapter and maybe get through 2-3 chapters for each episode, and we'll see how it goes, which means a lot of episodes as I think more about it.
Well, there are many things.
Yeah, there are many things. Exactly. So last time we did an introduction and started at chapter 1, we got all the way to chapter 2. So this time we are starting at chapter 3, and we'll see how far we can get. To start off, it's disclosure time. Brandis and I, we discussed last time, are working from review copies. Jared spent his hard-earned cash. Eitan, are you working from a contributor copy? Is that a thing that happened for you?
Yeah, either a contributor or they just handed me one.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that will not continue happening anymore, right, but yeah, you know.
No, that's what happens when you work at WotC or did.
I can say nothing about that.
Right. Absolutely.
Literally.
No, I get that. No. At one point in the introduction, I was going to say something about how you edited this book up until the culling of recent times, but I decided to take the better part of valor, but I guess I didn't now.
I mean, there are things I can say. I mean, actually, the book you will probably be reviewing sometime later this year, Vecna, Eve of Ruin, was the last thing that I edited that is complete.
Okay, excellent.
Nice.
Very good. I look forward to seeing it. I have been talking recently on the Discord about how, you know, I've been kind of building Vecna as a potential meta villain for all of the recent campaigns I've run. It's possible this could actually work for me in a larger sense. So
it's very meta.
Yeah, very. So we are talking about Chapter 3 first, and I didn't prep ahead of time and open my copy of the book. So what is the card for Chapter 3, if somebody could tell me real quick?
Balance.
It is the Balance card. So this chapter is kind of about using the cards for non-deck of many things style things, which is actually where my introduction came from. It's about using it for various inspirations or the actual inspiration mechanic or travel or encounters, all of these things where it's like, hey, we got these cool cards. Let's see what else we can do with them as random effects. Is that a fair gist?
I would say so. There's also alternate forms of even drawing a card, right? If you don't have a physical deck, they've got a thing for that.
Yes. Or, and this has been true for a long time with the deck committee things, there's the standard playing card alternatives as well.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now explain to me, and last time, Brandis, you were my go-to, at least on the Fool, because you understood the tarot version of the Fool. What does the concept of the balance have to do with these non-deck of many things sort of things? I'm trying to pick out the theme and how it connects to each card for each chapter, and I'm not sure I see how this represents balance, other than
the picture of the scales that we see on page 16 suggests an alternative, right? Two equal things.
Okay.
And so this is a chapter of alternative approaches that are, you know, equal in value, if not in outcome.
Okay. I can see that.
It's also using cards as randomizers.
But what does that have to do with balance?
Because there's no more, you know, emphasis on one than the other. You're randomizing.
I want you to imagine Heath Ledger saying something about chaos being fair.
I have an idea on this one, and it is not in any way informed by anything, because while I worked on this book, I have no idea why they named anything.
Sure.
So, but my initial guess was that it's to help you make balanced encounters.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's about encounters. Yeah.
They talk about, like, at the beginning, they talk about the value of using card mechanics over dice, because you can do things like customize, you know, I can't take the 18 and the 4 off of a D20 when I roll a die, right? I can just pull those cards if I don't want those random things to be a thing in my game. You know, and so they talk about how you can do that. You can stack the deck, like I definitely did back in my Curse of Strahd game. I'm holding up my Taroka cards, right? Where I definitely wanted to have certain things to be in certain places, so I just put them in the order that I needed them in the card in order to do the reading and make it work out the way I wanted
what?
To. Yeah. But one of the things that I think is interesting about using a card mechanic instead of a dice mechanic is you can eliminate repeatability, right? If I'm rolling a die to determine a random encounter or to determine a random effect of inspiration or whatever, if I'm pulling a card, I just don't put that card back in the deck. And so then it never comes up again. If I'm rolling a die, I might roll the same encounter multiple times. And then I've got to like, okay, let me re-roll. And it becomes a little bit more of a distraction. Plus, if you can tie the effect to the cool art on the card, then you know, chef's kiss, even better.
Right. And there are many games where people have used cards as their die replacement randomizer, mm-hmm. so that they could know the distribution of numbers would be as it should be, and not, you know, you couldn't actually have a run of good or bad luck as such for real. Just a weird shuffle.
Yeah, there are even games that use it as part of character creation.
Mm-hmm. I've been hired more than one time to write or otherwise contribute to a tarot deck style product for a game, right? In one case, it was a third-party product from Morkborg. In another case, it was a D&D setting where the deck is intended to be used for encounter building and adding an unexpected twist to an encounter midway through, that kind of thing. So what's going on here in general with the journey spread, the inspiration hand, the encounter deck, all of these, this is D&D using ideas that not only has D&D used before, but they've become common currency in other design.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's sort of, to my mind, that's the meat of this chapter, is those three different specific ways of using the deck, right? The inspiration hand, the journey spread, and the encounter deck, right? Before that, there's a smaller little section about using, they call it card sparks, where it's just like,
right,
pull the card, look at the image, get some inspiration. What do you see in the picture, in the actual artwork? Because the cards do have, if you're using the actual deck that comes with the book, has just beautiful artwork, right? Yeah. With lots of little details, lots of things going on.
All of the art in all of these cards is gorgeous. Right. They really hit it with that.
So that first real like little bit in this chapter is like, you know, pull a card and see what's there, and you know, that's your thing. That's your NPC. What do you see? I don't know. Make something up. It looks cool.
But they mentioned this really obscure game that I just couldn't, you know, remember where it came from. Mm-hmm. That also has fantasy things on it. I don't know.
This other card game that's all about cards and a little less role playing. Yeah. That's owned by the same company. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They do discuss using magic cards as a source of inspiration. If you happen to have a giant stack of magic cards sitting around and just pulling up and looking at the artwork there and being like, hey, that's a cool thing. Let's make that an inspiration for the NPC or the idea.
I did.
Leader. I mean, I feel like that's also a rather nice fit for, I don't know if you have some sort of Magic the Gathering based setting. If you happen to acquire that somehow, it's hard to imagine, but go with me on this.
There's a bunch of them.
There are several.
There are. I like many of them a lot.
So that's sort of the opening smaller piece. The intro piece is like, you can just pull the cards and use the art for inspiration on things. There's not a ton of guidance on this, and it's kind of a little bit like, pull a card, look at cool art, and see if it sparks any ideas. It's very, very improv-y, which if you're not a DM looking to do more sort of look at something for inspiration and get improv, okay, don't worry about that page, I guess, but it's not a very big section, so it's not like you're missing out on much.
Yeah. I will say that like my brain does not especially work that way. That tends to slow me down more than help me, but I don't object to other people having things that help them. And that'd be weird.
And there are certain games that are very much like the DM has to improv a lot, right? Game prep is not really a thing. It's just sort of be ready to come in and make things up as you go, right? And so it taps into that part of my gaming brain that I've been trying to exercise more as I've looked into some of those games, right? It's a little bit Fiasco where there is no GM. It's a little bit Blades in the Dark is more improv-y, and I've been looking and reading a lot about Blades in the Dark from a GM perspective. So there is definitely those are gaming muscles I've been trying to flex recently. So I could see myself, using the cards in that way a little bit, but it's also tricky because like between the deck of many things and the deck of many more things that are also included in this physical product, there's a lot of cards. Am I just going to flip through this giant stack of cards and try to figure out how to shuffle them and come up with a random deck to just pull from? I don't know. Maybe I will. We'll see how it goes. The real meat of this chapter, though, is in describing the inspiration hand, the journey spread, and the encounter deck. There was clearly an effort there to, like, somebody pulled out their thesaurus because they didn't want to just call them three different kinds of decks, you know? But,
you know. Probably didn't need a thesaurus. Jason Tondra has pretty good vocabulary.
Right. But the point stands that they were working really hard not to just call this three different kinds of decks. So,
yeah.
Which is fine.
I'm still here.
Okay. The first one listed here is the inspiration hand, and I find this interesting because it's a variation from inspiration as it exists in the rules. It's instead of using inspiration to get advantage on a roll, it's get inspiration and draw a card from the deck of many things. And then here's this chart that tells you all the different things that you could get from it, or whether it's advantage on a check or In fact, there's one that's advantage on an ability check, another one that's advantage on an attack roll, another one that's advantage on a saving throw, so it is arguably inspiration using this deck, generally speaking, well, in some cases, is weaker than just getting inspiration rules as written, right?
Right. Puzzle, Rogue, and Star are sort of, okay, but you know that's less, right?
Right.
Because I only get one of those. But the rest of them are pretty incredible.
Okay, what's your favorite?
Well, I mean, in terms of this is powerful, Key is crazy. Because it's it's Misty Step. Right, it's just
as a bonus action teleport with anything you're wearing. 30, yeah. So you just as a bonus action get a free Misty Step.
Yeah, I mean, Void is great. It's uncanny dodge, and so on. Right, and
M is crazy. I mean that one is taking additional action.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That is wild.
Now, interestingly, Fates is basically what I've house ruled inspiration. How I've house ruled inspiration to work anyway. So
sure,
I just let them make a reroll.
I have opined more than one time on air that it'd be awfully nice if that's how inspiration worked as a standard. But here we are. Like flames, okay, 1d6 extra fire damage is not the most impressive. Mm-hmm. I think we'd have to say, an average of 3 damage compared to these other things. Okay. I feel like that could have been goosed up just a little bit.
Here's the thing, though. Some of the like inspiration as it works now is fairly like explainable in the heroic cinematic world of adventuring and what have you, right? Some of these are just outright like you've done some good role playing. Now you get to do a magic thing, like
right? You've got to have as a premise that like the cards sort of tie reality together and a person could manifest a card from the deck in a sense at any time. I get a very sort of magical girl anime moment from that.
Sure.
I don't mean that as any kind of bad thing. I think it's an interesting perspective on D&D. It fits some kinds of D&D quite well.
Yes. And that's what I'm saying is that using inspiration, using some of these card effects from inspiration changes the fiction of the setting a little bit. And so DMs need to be aware of that going into it so that they can make it work for their setting.
I would suggest that was a tone quite common to 4E.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
I was just going to say that was my observation too is I'm not sure that I want, my people in my party that are very non-magical to suddenly have their opponent travel to another plane because they use their inspiration. It's neat. There's some neat effects. I almost wish that this would have had a more overtly magical effect and then a more mundane effect, and you could choose between the two. Mm. But that's me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind it so much because I feel like there's always an in-game reason you could say it happened. Like, maybe they traveled to another plane because of something related to them. Or maybe you actually all along had a potion of I throw it at you and you leave this plane. So, you can explain it. I mean, you might have to ad-lib why it works. Right. But, I mean,
I could see
that's the kind of DMing I do anyway.
Right. I could see the come up with a mundane reason for the extra D6 of fire damage. Like, I swung my sword through the lamp, shattering it with and spilling oil all over the blade when I did my, attack or whatever and explain it away that way. If you wanted to go more mundane reason, But it is a little bit more to sort out. And I don't know how you come up with a mundane explanation of teleporting your opponent to another plane or misty stepping, as a bonus
just action. Just moved really fast.
Yeah. It suddenly turned into the Flash and just zipped over there.
Totally normal thing. Totally normal.
Right. With those things aside, assuming I'm able to get past that, and I've actually considered, we were talking on the Discord recently about stuff going on with my home game and how I'm playing Witchlight. We're just starting really session one on Friday. And I don't want to take away inspiration from having not having the last thing because of the way I've done inspiration at my table for years now. And so I didn't want to take away the inspiration mechanic from them, from having their things lost. And one of the ideas that occurred to me as I was getting ideas from Jared and some other folks on the channel, was what if I used this as the inspiration mechanic, but every time they got inspiration, they drew two cards and then I got to pick which one they kept, and that way I'm not taking away inspiration. But I'm able to like signify, but you've lost this thing. There's something missing. Your mojo's gone, whatever. A little bit there. The issue I had with that as I was thinking about it, though, is there's a long chart full of things that the cards do, right? So they drew a card, but it doesn't say on the card what the inspiration effect is on the card. They've got to consult a chart and then remember it for the next 4 hours while we're playing in hopes that it occurs to them when the time comes and they're used to inspiration working a certain way.
Definitely a use case for post-it notes or index cards.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was thinking I might just open up the digital version and just copy and paste all these and make my own cards and print them off. But that's
already a, but it's a problem with inspiration in general. That mechanic has been challenging because people always forget to use it, including myself.
Which is why I do it a very specific way. And inspiration actually gets used 3-4 times a session for me. It's working well. But definitely when there's 22 different variations of what inspiration does, nobody's going to remember what their inspiration is supposed to do tonight, versus last night or whatever. So if I print it off like little condition cards, okay, you drew your card. Now here's your little reminder of what that does, because I don't know that I want to write 22 index cards worth of information. So if I just copy and paste and print, that might suffice. We'll see.
I had an idea when, go ahead.
I've got 4 days to figure it out. what's your idea?
The idea I had, and this might not work every time, was that for if you're going to use inspiration in this system, you don't have to use it exclusively, but like one thing could be the DM maybe could keep some of these in their back pocket. And then if they like the idea you had, or maybe the DM encourages you to describe things creatively or find creative problem solving, they give it as almost like a reaction, like it happens on the spot. Hmm. So like they could just award it as you're doing it and then make sure that it's appropriate to what you did.
Right. So you get inspiration right now. You have to use it right now.
I also kind of like the idea of it being sort of a milestone. Like if you accomplish this thing in the game, you get this card, depending on what choices they make and which direction they go and what they accomplish in what order.
No, absolutely. But then we're back to, they have to remember what it does. I got to figure out a solution to that. And I know my players well enough that I don't want to like just hand them the table and say, here, look at your card, look at this. It'll tell you what you can do, because then they're going to start looking at all the things they didn't get and like opining and focusing on the things they didn't get. And it's going to take them out of it. So it's a problem it's not like there's no solutions. It's just an issue of whether or not I'm going to have the time to put together the solutions before I play on Friday. So any other thoughts on the inspiration hand?
I think my last thing is that I'd like to see Puzzle, Rogue, and Star goosed up just a little bit.
So this is not just inspiration, but worse?
Right. Something like advantage and here have a D6 or something. I don't know. Or advantage and one die is bumped up to a 10 if it isn't already high. I don't know.
I suppose... Yeah. I suppose in the world of
like Warden, those feel like a bad draw, an actively bad draw.
Well, except they're not actively bad. They're not a disadvantage. They're not as good as what you'd have if you weren't doing this system, right?
That's what I mean. It means that this system is now worse for you than nothing.
Right. Well, worse for you than what you had before.
Right.
Yes.
That given everything else going on here, that feels inappropriate to me.
I can see that. Although in the world of randomness, I mean, this is the sort of part and parcel to the deck is that some of the things are good and some of the things aren't as good as the others, right? Or
that's part and parcel to the deck, but not to this application of it.
Well,
to me,
it seems that in fact it is part and parcel to this application because those three cards exist.
Yeah,
I disagree with you, but that's okay.
One thing I think you could do would be to have people pick their card in the beginning of the session and just hand it to them or whatever. And then if they get inspiration, that's what it does every time. And I would just take those three cards out because I don't happen to like the idea of this being worse. However, if it is your replacement mechanic, then it's probably okay that it's worse because everything else is so much better that, I would give it to them at the beginning. And that way for this whole session, they've acquired this weird power. Maybe you've introduced wild magic into your world in some new way. So,
right. Well, and I mean, there were previous chapters discussed at length about you can just customize the deck. So if Brandis isn't feeling those three cards, pull those three cards, and now those aren't options.
Yeah,
or replace them with something you like better.
Yeah. So, okay.
Three actions per round.
Yeah. Let's talk about the journey spread. In many ways, I feel like the journey spread is the section with more uniqueness. That makes sense, right? I mean, the inspiration hand and the encounter deck is mostly like have a table of things that it does and pull a card and that's the thing that it does, right? The journey spread does other kinds of things. Like there's no table here of things to reference. Somebody explain the journey spread to us.
It's very much sort of an adventure oracle, right? There's lots of oracle decks for helping you come up with adventures. Good starter. You'll find probably half a dozen at any given time. And so this is especially for structuring multi-day journeys and making sure that there's kind of a balance of good and bad as well as the challenge of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's pretty cool, right? There are challenges in D&D with multi-day journeys, and this is here to help you structure them. I like that.
Yeah, I actually really like this concept. I have done clunkier versions of this that are not nearly as stylistic as to use something that has actually been in the game since.
Yeah, and the concept is like for every day of travel, because that's, I mean, it's not an adventure creator. It's sort of a what happens while I'm going from point A to point B, as one does in Tyranny of Dragons, Out of the Abyss, Empire of the Ghouls, if we want to go talk to our friends at Kobold Press, right? There's all kinds of
things under.
Yeah, there's all kinds of adventures where there's just like, okay, you're going to travel for a week or two or whatever. And the idea is you pull two cards for each day and you stack them. And the top card is, this is the challenge that you run into. This represents the challenge you run into during the day. And the bottom card is, and this is the either reward or penalty, the reward or ruin that faces you that day. And that way it's just sort of a way of creating almost daily what happens on a day-to-day basis. And they may be, you know, depending on your inspiration, they may be big things, you know, here's an encounter. It may be small things, you know, you ran into some other travelers on the road and had a chat about the recent goings ons, you know? So it could be all kinds of things, but it sort of works. It has that almost tarot reading style of, okay, what does the day foretell?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about using it because I want to take a break from DMing my Keys from the Golden Vault campaign for adventure or two, but maybe just one. And I have some players who are interested in trying their hand at, you know, DMing for a little while, but they're also a little bit afraid of coming up with things on the spot. Mm-hmm. So something like this could be really good for them and also do less, deal less damage to my campaign in case that, you know, because what happens here is not really that much could destroy anything. Right. So hopefully.
Now the, on the, it does, there's other than that sort of mechanic that I just described, the top card, the bottom card sort of thing, this section doesn't have, it's a little bit less, it's a little more inspiration-y with slightly more guidance than you saw in the card sparks. Cause the card sparks was like, look at the art and see what strikes you. Right. This one gives you some ideas. Like these are the kinds of challenges. These are the kinds of rewards or whatever, but none of them are tied to specific cards like they are in the previous section or in the next section where there's a table that says, okay, if you pull the dungeon, this is the kind of thing that you might run into or whatever.
Right. So, this is more like categories of ways to think about what you see on the card.
Right. And so yeah. So it might be like, you run into an encounter, you run into, you know, there's a weather event. And so your travel takes longer or, you know, you had an easier time foraging for food or you found some treasure or whatever. But it doesn't specifically say like, if you pull these cards, do this thing. So it's still a little bit like pull the card, be inspired by the card. But then here's some categories of things you can pick from. So you're not just making it all up off the top of your head.
I like that this illustrates something that people have said about 5e ever since people started talking about pillars, and that is all of these things are not, you are in the wilderness and you have to fight a thing. There is a variety of things that might be interacting with other people, it might be interacting with the environment. And I feel like even though we have seen that illustrated many times, a lot of people still default away from that. And then blame D&D for it because there's inertia from other editions, which is not necessarily fair. So I really appreciate that there is another official, you know, instance here of showing, look, when you're having encounters, it does not have to be a thing that you, you know, get ready to fight.
Yeah. My
yep, I agree with that strongly. Yep.
My favorite part of this section is that because it's a little more abstract than the previous and the upcoming sections, is that they then spend considerable time with an example, right? It's not, so it's a little more abstract. It's not so simple as you pull a card and this is what it means. It's pull a card and then interpret what it means, but let us show you exactly how that might work. And I like it when they give examples. And, you know, I am not a new dungeon master. Right. I have been DMing D&D for over 20 years. And yet it still helps me to sort of wrap my head around a concept to see the example and see how it plays out in a situation like this. And so I appreciate that. And I imagine if you are newer to D&D and you haven't been dungeon mastering for 20 plus years, those examples are even more powerful. All right. Other thoughts on the journey spread?
The only other thought I was going to throw out there about this is the same thought I have about the next section, which is I would love to see an adventure written that actually uses this specifically for that adventure. I'm not expecting to ever see it, but I would love to.
It's a little tricky, right?
Because I assume that you could go straight to the DM's Guild for that. Like, that is a thing that the DM's Guild could really cover. WotC can't, because they have a strict and strictly admirable policy of never assuming you have anything but the three core books.
Yes.
That's what I was going to say. And they played around a little bit with outside non-core books, other products, with the Dragonlance adventure where they integrated the board game that came out at the same time. I don't know.
These were marketed together and we hope you bought them both is sort of a separate thing.
It is a little different than this.
Yeah. Right?
It's different. But even then, I don't know. I didn't play that adventure and run the board game with it. Although I have both of them, because Watsy sent them to me. But I don't know how much of a raging success that was, especially given that, the discount store Ollie's has had an overstock of those board games, for several times now that I've noticed it, where you can go and buy them for $2 or $3. So I'm guessing the board game did not get the boost in sales that they were hoping when that adventure came out. So the last section for chapter 3, so see, 36 minutes in, we're almost done with chapter 3. The last
section, good timing, great pace.
Good. The last section for chapter 3 is the encounter deck. And the idea is use the deck of many things, draw a card, and that card represents whatever random encounter you needed to have, right? And then on one hand, I look at it and I'm like, okay, well, sure, that's a thing, right? You could put a random encounter chart down and figure things out. And then you realize just how long this section is, and that they then proceed to give you table after table. Well, no, not table, two tables as examples of was it Corrupted Lands and Forest Encounters, to be like, see, this is how you could do it.
So this is really taking advantage of the thing we were saying about the difference between dice and cards, right? Yeah. Because it is much easier to have a card either permanently leave the deck or be transformed in its meaning, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to increase the chance that it gets drawn again by putting it back, right? I think that's great.
Here's the thing about that for me, though, is that they give you these two examples of the Forest and the Corrupted Lands encounters.
Right.
But they didn't use the deck of many things for it. It's only standard playing card listings.
That's a space saving thing, right? They have to fit a lot on that table, and so I think they're expecting you to translate playing card to deck of many things card in the standardized way. But yeah, it's maybe more complicated. I would
agree with you on that. I don't know that I'm going to buy that.
Either that, or they had a piece of an idea lying around, and this is where they decided to use it. But
yeah,
that's probably not quite the workflow.
I really do like, though, that this system is not just assign an encounter to each of the cards. There are special types of cards that if you draw them, they interact in a special way with other types of cards. So there is more of a developed system other than just, you know, use this instead of a die.
Sure.
Yeah. And there's all kinds of extra sort of advice on, you know, like, there's a twin card. You pull the twin card, and now it's like draw two and splice these things together. Now there's bandits with displacer beasts. Are they teamed up? Are they fighting each other and you stumble into the middle of it? I don't know, but they're both in this encounter somehow.
Yeah. Displacer, owl, beast, bear.
Right? So there's interesting things there. This is where I'd mentioned, again, I'm thinking a lot about my upcoming Witchlight campaign, right? And this is where I think we talked 2 weeks ago that I got inspiration from this book, and it was in this chapter of I want Prismere to function a little bit like the Winter Court from the Dresden Files, right? That without Zabilna there to hold the Far Realm at bay, that slowly Far Realmy things are just invading the world because she's not there to stop them. And that I'm going to represent that by creating encounter decks And some of the cards are going to represent sort of aberration things that represent the Far Realm sort of leaking in. And the further along we get into the campaign, the more of those cards I'm going to slip into the deck. And so it'll be a random thing, but at first there's, a slight chance that you might run into, an Intellect Devourer or something. But by the time you get to the end, it's like, oh, and then there's a squad of Mind Flayers flying in on their Nautiloid through a portal, or whatever. And I think that'll be a nice way of showing the slow breakdown of the walls in reality because Zabilna is frozen. And I think the encounter deck is a interesting way of incorporating and telling that story.
I like that.
What's funny is as I was doing the notes for this, I was also finishing up playing Marvel's Midnight Suns. And it really got me to thinking, like, in there are certain times when if you attack this enemy, you free up this card and it shows up in your hand. And you could incorporate something like that into your encounter deck. Not necessarily that there is a direwolf walking around with a card on top of it, but that that if they do this specific thing, it changes the deck in that you either pull this out of there, or you add this other thing in there that is now a possibility that wasn't until they did that.
That's a lot of fun. I like that a lot.
What if you combine some ideas? You use the Deck of Many Things cards for the encounter deck. You overcome the challenge of the encounter deck, and then the person in the party most instrumental or whatever gets rewarded with that card as an inspiration card. Right? So
this is why Jeff is the master of tying multitasking everything that he has.
I really like the idea of the affecting campaign other things. It's often tricky to try to remember everything that's going on or supposed to be going on, or you just don't bother paying attention to it. But you could use this as a sort of a management system in the background for like, well, because you didn't do this thing here, or because you did do this thing here, that thing happened, and you'll go find out about it next time or not. Mm-hmm. And that way, if they do go to a weird place, then, they'll encounter that thing that they caused.
Right.
Yes, and if you show them the deck changing in a material way, that adds a certain weight to the action, mm-hmm. right? It, like, kind of let them see you put the card in the deck, even if you don't tell right. them what it all means.
Yeah.
Just do it for fun anyway, even if it doesn't do anything.
The beginning of every session, I'll take the encounter deck and I'm like, okay, I need to add these two cards to the deck. Why? I don't know. I guess we'll find out.
Jeff, why do you have three copies of the dungeon? What's up?
Yeah. That's weird. All right. Any other thoughts on chapter 3? We should probably get at least two chapters done tonight.
That's a super good goal, buddy. It's a super good goal.
We're going to do 11 of these episodes. To get through them all. Honestly, I thought when we started chapter 3, I'm like, wow, this is going really fast. We're going to be able to get through all three of Measy. Yeah, no, never mind. It is shocking to find out that four D&D fans can talk at length about literally anything. Should we move on to chapter 4?
Let's give it a shot.
Chapter 4 is the puzzle. I think I figured out the theme on this one.
I have feelings about this chapter, by the way.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah, because this is the one that I found the most challenging of the entire book.
Okay. So this chapter the card is the puzzle, or the card is puzzle. It's weird how some of the cards are the thing and the other ones are just thing.
That is a thing.
Yeah, no, it is. and it is, shockingly, a collection of puzzles, riddles, and traps, which they describe are all kind of just different variations of puzzles, which I think is fair. Eitan, you have thoughts on this chapter.
I hate puzzles. Okay, I've now seen it. Everybody knows I despise puzzles with a fiery burning passion. Word puzzles I'm good at. Every single other kind of thing, especially if it's complicated moving things, like, I hate them. So I am probably the best person to edit your puzzle on Earth, because if it's even slightly hard to understand, I will not get it at all. So, of course, when you meet lots of puzzles in something you're editing, it makes it so much more fun for you when you don't like puzzles. So, yeah, puzzles are a little bit of a pet peeve of mine and something that particular people really like. And that is not specific to anybody in this book, by the way. But yeah, so this one, I think, actually was not one of the more challenging set of puzzles. There's just some presentation things that are challenging. And you've seen the visuals for some of these puzzles are, you know, a lot. And that's a challenge for, you know, a lot of different people to do. But so, yeah, I think they did a great job with it. But, you know, this one was the one that I remembered the most.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, it's basically a selection of, like, here's a couple of examples of deck of many things themed puzzles. And here's some riddles. And here's a couple of traps. What's interesting to me is that it's just a collection of those things, right? There's not a lot of, like in the previous chapter, there was all kinds of advice. How do you use the deck for inspiration? You know, that kind of stuff, right? This one is like, no, here's our section on puzzles. And here's two puzzles. Ooh. Although there is some advice. And part of it, I think, is because puzzles are a tricky thing in role-playing games. Because puzzles, in many ways, are challenging the players, not the characters, right?
Yeah.
And that's a tricky balance to walk. And one of the things they explicitly say is, like, puzzles are fun. Some people really enjoy puzzles, but don't overdo it. Like, use it intentionally and do it at limited times.
That's right.
Yeah. And I mean, I do like the, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was gonna say, I think that's good advice. That's how I'd try to approach it.
I do like the sort of formalizing or semi-formalizing of the hint aspect, because I'm going to be the person who's going to want the hint.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to be the person who's going to cast a spell that bypasses the whole puzzle after I get frustrated. So, you know.
Yep.
The other thing that I like is that for most of these that are presented, there is a closed set of answers because they are all themed to the deck of many things. Mm-hmm. This is my problem when I am presented with a puzzle. If you ask me something that seems relatively innocuous, I think, in context of what? The entire universe exists, and this could be in multiple contexts in multiple ways, and then my brain shuts down and I'm done.
Right.
Standardized tests. You know, I can find reasons why there's something wrong with just about anything, so it is not the best answer.
Right. No, and I really like, of the two puzzles, because there's only two. Right. And it's interesting, like, there's only two puzzles. There was only two traps as well. But then there are 22 riddles because there's a riddle for each card in the deck. So just a taste of puzzles, a taste of traps and as many riddles as you could possibly use in a campaign. Because that's a lot, right? I also particularly like, because I primarily did my reading on through the D&D Beyond app on my iPad, and I really like the way they set up the riddles and that, like, here's the riddle, and now I have to actually click something if I want to see the answer, if I want to just try to figure it out on my own, right? Even as a DM. Obviously, that's a little harder to do on a physical book, but it's a neat little feature of looking at it digitally.
This is where I'm... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
This is where I want to pat Brandis on the back, because I play in one of his games, and one of the puzzles that we ran into exists in the context of the dungeon that we are exploring. Mm-hmm. In other words, my brain doesn't start thinking there could be any possibility of this. It's that this puzzle is going to have some solution that has something to do with this dungeon that we're in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what's really important to me when I encounter puzzles, because then my brain just, it's not like the DM is playing Riddler and he's just going to throw this riddle in here for no good reason other than to make himself feel smart.
Right. I think in my last campaign, which was based on Descent into Avernus, the only puzzle that I really used in the entire campaign was I got myself an actual puzzle box and had them solve a puzzle box in order to open the infernal puzzle box. Just because I thought it'd
be good times.
A neat prop. And I have the Beetle and Grimm platinum set, so I have the actual, like, metal plates for the contract that you find inside. So I actually put it inside the puzzle box for them to unlock and open, and then watch the, you know, as a DM, it's great. Like, I, All right, here it is. Solve the puzzle. I'll be back here for the next hour, hour and a half, while you all, as you four or five grown adults, try to figure out how to open this puzzle box.
Very escape room.
Yes. No, and yeah. But I wouldn't do it often.
In a lot of kinds of puzzles, any number of adults past two or three at the outside is a penalty to the overall.
That's true.
Success chances, let's say.
Yep. Yep. Agreed.
It, no matter how much they want to help, they are no longer able to positively contribute. That's just not how conversations work.
It's also not how physical space works. If you've got a puzzle box, only so many people can really look at it at a time.
But if you have a sufficiently easy puzzle, then all you need is time pressure, and you can make everyone's brains fall over.
It reminds me of a True Dungeon, if anybody's ever done that at Gen Con, where they have the puzzle box, which I never do because I'm one of the least dexterous people. You know, I would have less than an 8 if a person could have less than an 8 in dexterity. So, yeah.
Yep.
So I do not take that on, but Liz Liddell, who is the director of production, I believe, on Magic Gathering, who always used to organize our outings, she was good at that stuff.
Okay.
I said, you know, you're allowed to roll more than 1d6 for your dex score, right, bud? You can roll all 3d6.
You are allowed to, but it
all all three.
Yeah, and I rolled.
And then you add them. You don't just take the lowest.
whoever rolled my dice did not roll higher than a 6.
You have a stern word with a GM.
So, I mean, long story short, there's a bunch of riddles. There's a couple of puzzles. There's a couple of traps. One of the things I found interesting about the traps as well, we haven't talked as much about them. They both come with a little illustration, and then there's all this sort of, and here's all the various things. They're both complex traps. None of them are like simple traps. They're both really complex traps. But one of the things I find interesting about both of the traps is that there's no solution provided. It's just like, here's a weird obstacle. I don't know. There's a million things to do in D&D. Figure it out. hate.
Yeah, I think I broadly prefer that rather than, okay, find the one solution. But definitely. There's just one solution.
At least it's not a puzzle trap where every time you don't do the thing that you probably won't figure out, you get, a ceiling smashed down on top of you.
Right. No, and I don't hate a trap with a solution other than the fact that it puts in DM's heads that that is the solution and they don't allow people to creatively come up with other solutions. But this doesn't do that because there are no solutions given. Here's a trap, figure it out. How do the inhabitants of this dungeon get from across that balance beam? I don't know. We're not going to worry about that.
What that reminds me of is something that I'm thinking about doing a little bit more in my current campaign, which is trying to give players a way to get clues or figure out how to solve problems with existing resources they have. So like somebody's like, I'm not sure I'm getting this. Can I get a clue? I'd be like, well, does anybody have any spells that might give them clues? And then, cast a guidance spell or druid craft or whatever that might give them a hint on this particular problem, sure, if it's relevant.
I agree with that, and I would love to see some really clever design go into additional information gathering spells for something like that, though that is a very challenging form of design.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see either a product or something that WotC puts out in which they can give a meta uses for spells and other abilities where it's like, just because this is a combat ability or gives you a plus 1d4 bonus or whatever doesn't mean that it might not have some applicability in a little bit more of an abstract way. So like, what can you do with action surge besides, attack again? You could maybe, it lets you speed across that particular thing, which is why you teleported. So, I'd like to see that, but it is very challenging and isn't a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. And if it is, then it's not that useful.
Right.
That's right.
All right. Go ahead.
And there's just sort of a whole thing of you don't want every tool to be right for every problem, but broadening generally is still a good premise. Right? Like, Fireball is so good at combat, it doesn't need to be an information gathering spell. That's what I'm getting at.
Right. But if you get rid of everything, then there might be something under it.
It's possible. Yeah.
Trying to find silver lining.
So do we have other thoughts on chapter 4, our puzzles, traps, and riddles chapter?
I have one thought that I feel bad for having, and that is reading the balance and ruin and seeing all of this, you know, metal underneath there and how it's moving and how there's just a ton of it down there. Immediately makes me think that fifth edition does not write things the way third edition did, because you would have had to account for the fact that the players would scrap all of that metal and figure out how to resell it and break their wealth cap.
Yep. Mm.
There may be some benefits to gold being less useful in this edition. The players don't have quite as much incentive to just do weird, obnoxious crap.
Right.
I don't know. I'm running in the Forgotten Realms where somebody can find something to buy with everything.
Fair enough.
So here's my question. Chapter 5, the gem. No, chapter 5, gem. There's no the. is a big list of new magic items.
I do love big lists of new magic items. I'm not going to lie. That is a good time.
Doesn't suffice to say. It sounds like the answer is no, Brandis. Doesn't suffice to say that Chapter 5 is a big, long list of new magic items, and we can talk about it in 2 minutes and then wrap up the episode.
I agree with that.
Do you want to dive in deeper and go through specific items?
I mean, I've been writing for Tribality since forever, and even in my reviews for them, I can't bring myself to cover every magic item. It's just not interesting to hear someone talk about every magic item that way. I'm sorry. It's not.
Because we're willing to say this is a big list of a whole bunch of magic items that are deck of many things themed that run from, do we have any common? No, they run from uncommon to legendary.
Yeah.
And call it good at that. Hey, here's a whole bunch of new magic items and call it good.
They're great.
I've done too.
I will say that there are some in here that I think could get some real cachet and become quite popular. Mm-hmm. When 6th edition eventually comes along, this goes in the DMG because it's gained that kind of fan cachet because it's just doing a kind of thing that people want magic items to do. I like Rogue's Mantle a lot, is what I'm trying to tell you. right. And just seeing a magic flail, just any magic flail, like that's not, it doesn't happen in official releases. So I'm delighted. And I would extend that broadly, like the Rod of Hellish Flames is a very iconic style, right? It does exactly the kind of thing you expect to see, but there haven't been the profusion of magic warlock rods in 5e. There are some, don't get me wrong, there are some. There's not a profusion of them the way there are in 4e.
Sure.
Yeah. I was happy to see magic bow. There's like no magic bows in 5e.
Right.
The only thing that I would say, because I think overall these are a lot of great magic items, and if you want more magic items, this is a good list of extra ones to have. And I had a lot of imaginative thoughts about a lot of them. But I did want to mention Warrior's Passkey was kind of the most blunt magic item. It's a key that can manifest a sword.
Huh.
I
feel like maybe there's a Disney lawsuit waiting to happen.
I have asked that question many times and have learned that apparently the risk of lawsuits on some of these things is far less than people might think it is.
Yeah. Sure. But I also wanted to call out Yuryalis. We looked up the pronunciation last time. Yuryalis Aegis. It's a legendary shield. I just love that you get a cool ass Medusa shield. That rules. Yep. That's a really, really nice like mythic nod.
Mm-hmm. It is. No, there's lots of cool magic items listed here. I'm not particularly displeased with any of the things I see. It's a lot of interesting and creative magic items.
Oh.
There's nothing really boring.
And you mentioned how there was advice in a lot of the chapters. Mm-hmm. The Sudden Riches advice is great.
I was going to say, there's technically two other things in this chapter. There's the Sudden Riches advice on what do you do when somebody pulls the gym card and now suddenly they're way wealthier than they probably should be, right? And how do you justify that? Or how does it, there's all these different like storylines of here's a way in game, in narrative to explain the sudden wealth, right? Oh, and it's not all positive. I like the very first example. One of the party's patrons died and just left you all this money. But that also means one of your patrons is dead, right? Okay, we're rich.
Yep. Like, so in 3.5 era, I played in a game where the premise was in the first session or two, we got 1,000,000 gold pieces.
Yep.
Now what? Is the rest of the campaign?
Yep.
Because we're too rich to spend it. We too rich to even let anyone know we have it.
Right.
And so, like, build a psychotically well-defended safe, job one. Okay? Now what do we do the rest of this? Because we haven't solved our problem. Right. And, of course, problems spun out of that, right? It was great. But I love the idea of, like, okay, you have a huge new asset with a few caveats.
It's one
I want you to imagine Robin Williams saying that to you. Sorry, Robin Williams.
It's one of the one of the interesting things about Dragon Heist Waterdeep as an adventure is that you spend the whole adventure looking for this loot of what is it, 500,000 gold, right? And then you get to the end and it's like, okay, but then other people show up and say, hey, you can't have all of that 500,000 gold. That doesn't really belong to you. It belongs to the people of Waterdeep. But here's your reward, right? You're still going to get a big reward, but you've been spent 3 levels, 4 levels, whatever it is, looking for 500,000 gold, and we're going to take it away from you, right? So on one hand, like, that's very disappointing. On the other hand, like, yeah, but what else are you going to do? If you're going to continue a campaign with these characters, like, giving them 500,000 gold is campaign changing. Like, the whole game is something different now.
If you want a campaign with lots of money, go for the Vecna campaign.
Yeah, well, that one goes to level 20, so that,
it does, and there's lots of money in there.
Yeah.
I did have one item that, there's only one item on this whole list, is one that I wish did something different, not because there's anything wrong with the item, but because the Ring of Puzzler's Wit, I wanted one where the player can just say, we skipped this puzzle, but...
I bet you did.
Yep. there is one other thing in this chapter besides a bunch of magic items and advice on what to do when you get real rich real fast. There's a page that's really an index, right? Mm-hmm. It feels like a page that normally would have been a table at the end of the book. So with all of the magic items in the book, like many of those magic items are in this chapter. Many of them are also in chapter 9, and all the way up to chapter 20, right? So there's magic items throughout the book. And that was one of my early thoughts on this book, is like, wow, as a reference book at the table, this book isn't very helpful, right? Because there's stuff scattered all over the place. But at least there's some effort here to be like, yeah, but if you're looking for those magic items, at least here's a table where you can find them. It's weird that it's in chapter 5. Like, I got to get a quarter of the way into the book before I can find the reference of figuring out how to find the things in the book. But it makes thematic sense. So if you're looking for it, beginning of chapter 5 will tell you where all the magic items are.
They had to put it somewhere because I remember having discussions to be like, hey, can you edit the magic items? And I was like, which magic items?
Right,
so now at least we know what they all are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, because I don't want to spoil anything, but the next chapter starts off with more magic items. Right.
Well, because it's so many things, you don't know what card you're going to draw. They can't all be in one place.
Right. All right. I think we've gotten through 3 chapters. It only took us probably about an hour. I mean, it was 5 minutes of chit-chat at the beginning there, I think. So, We did it, guys. I mean, we really did a summarized version of that last chapter, but we got through three chapters. Yay! So next time we're going to prepare 5, 6, 7, and 8, and we'll see how far we get if we get through all three of them, and we'll see who our guest is that time around. So, but for now, I'm going to call that the end of the episode. I do want to say thank you to our guests, Eitan Bernstein. If people want to find out more about what you're up to or reach out to you, how should they do so?
They can go to my website, which is eitanbernstein.com, or they can look for me on probably Facebook is the simplest, just because I don't want to do things with Twitter anymore, or what it's currently known as, or Instagram. So yeah, just social media or Facebook, or go to my website.
There you go. Brandis Stoddard, where should people go to find you?
You can find me on Blue Sky, where I am brandisstoddard.bsky.social. You can find me on tribality.com. My personal blog is brandisstoddard.com, and my Patreon is brandisstoddard. Today, I posted to my Patreon about the Alter Self spell, and I have opinions.
I am shocked to learn that Brandis Stoddard has opinions on a thing.
That's sort of my whole job here.
Jared Rasher, where can people go if they want to find more of Jared?
I am terrible about referring people to social media anymore, because it's just been like, I'm trying a bunch of places. Maybe you'll find me. That's cool.
Do you use the same screen name on all of them?
I've actually been trying to tie it more closely to my blog, which is whatdoiknowjr.com. If you would like to go there and read the reviews that I do on a variety of RPGs, or you can also find me at Gnome Stew, because I also do a lot of the RPG reviews that show up on Gnome Stew. And you can also find me if you look for Thacko with Advantage, because that is the podcast that I do with my friend Ange. And I don't think there's too many other things that you find if you search for those particular words.
All right.
Thank you, by the way. We don't have enough reviews of RPGs.
I try.
I also want to thank everybody who supports the show by being patrons over at patreon.com/thetomeshow. You all help me pay the bills, without which I would have to pay for it out of my own pocket, I guess, because I'm probably not going to stop the show. You can reach out to me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. You can find me on social media as Squatch, S-Q-U-A-C-H. If I am on a social media thing, that's probably my name. And I'm on a bunch of them, many of which I don't check unless I see notifications. We're going to call that episode 365, where we drew our second card from the deck of many things. In this episode of
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.